Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. I'm John Peters Coleman, and on this week's show we have Ornella and Zoe. They're from Southwest Against Nuclear, and they've popped in to talk to us about their latest campaign. Anthea Page finds out about a newly opened banking museum in Edinburgh. Our engineer and newest reporter, Mike Noyce, introduces us to another local band called Dharma Foundation. Tony Gosling continues his trip around Bristol's illustrious aviation history. This week he speaks to Oliver Dearden on how Bristol beat the US and Russia to develop the Concorde. As well as all that, we also have poetry from Tim Burrows and Mark Sayers and another episode of Treasure Island and our What's On Guard, of course. Well, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Ornella and Zoe. Hello.
Hi.
So how long has Southwest Against Nuclear been going then?
Well, we sort of formed late last year when we became aware of the government's consultation about new nuclear development as part of their national planning strategy.
Okay. I suppose really the best thing to do is to try and update people if they're not fully aware. What are the full plans for nuclear in the area specifically?
The government wants to build 8 nuclear power stations all over the UK, and they want to build 2 locally, one at Hinkley Point and one at Albury.
Right. What stopped you from joining, presumably there must have been an organisation already against nuclear?
There's a nationwide network of groups against nuclear. Local to Bristol, there's the Stop Hinkley group, and there's also a group in Albury called SANE. But we felt that Bristol needed representation because we're bang in the middle of those 2 nuclear sites, and the people of Bristol are also going to be affected if anything should happen at either of those places.
It's also trying to mobilise everyone together in the southwest. As one, we're trying to come together with everyone in the southwest to stop the new build, basically.
Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about why you're so against nuclear. There has been a famous accident in Japan, but, you know, we are told that these things are relatively rare and not commonplace.
I don't think anything that dangerous should even be considered when there are alternatives that are safe, which use the power of the sun, the wind, the waves, and which are much cheaper to set up and run, and the technology is available to us right now. Nuclear power, the government is heralding it as a low CO2 emitting power source, but from cradle to grave, it involves mining uranium, it involves processing uranium, which leaves massive amounts of toxic waste, building the power station, which uses huge amounts of energy, and then we've got the ongoing problem of nuclear waste, radioactive for thousands of years, which we have yet to find a solution for. So I think there's far better ways to access electricity than through something so dangerous and polluting.
Do you not think that green energy is perhaps too slow in development by its nature? It seems to not really have filled the gap that is evidently going to be there by the time a lot of other power stations are closed. I mean, the government don't really have any choice, do they?
Well, the plans for new nuclear build are to replace the existing nuclear power stations that we've got in this country. The lead-in will take at least 15 to 20 years at the rate things are going, by which time the energy gap will already have arrived. And in fact, the government could invest money in insulating all the homes in the UK, which would save the equivalent amount of energy as 10 new nuclear power stations, according to a C&D report.
Okay.
The other thing is political will. And basically, it's got nothing to do with energy why they want nuclear power stations. They want nuclear power stations to stay at the top of the military-industrial complex, to stay at the top of the UN, to maintain the UK government, to maintain themselves as a nuclear power.
Is that why you think perhaps Germany so readily abandoned nuclear as an option? Because they're not really, by the nature, on the top.
It's possible that's why it's been easier for them to abandon it, but they've also had like 20,000 people turning up to stop a nuclear train, 50,000 turning up for demonstrations. They've been demonstrating for years. So when Fukushima happened, I think that was like the green light to go stop, because they had an informed public, which we haven't.
But if they were, say, a top nuclear power and a member of the UN Security Council, do you not think that they would probably just simply overcome opposition and continue with nuclear much in the way that we are?
Possibly, but they're not. And I think the lesson that we can learn from Germany and Italy is that they've completely refused nuclear power. And in fact, Germany is saying that there's a boom in jobs in the green energy field. So when you're talking about the need to keep the lights on, this is a myth that the government has constructed to make people think we need nuclear to survive climate change or we have no other energy, which is rubbish, you know.
I remember being told as a child that you can't just turn a nuclear power station into a bomb. It's not like a bomb. It doesn't really work like that. The nuclear energy is not really related to weaponry. It's like having all the ingredients for a cake, but they're mixed in different ways. And yet now I'm being told that nuclear energy is sort of connected to weaponry and nuclear weapons. Is it or not?
The weapons are made from the byproduct of nuclear power, which is plutonium. Uranium is used as the main fuel for nuclear power stations, but as a waste product, it turns into plutonium after the reaction has taken place. And that plutonium is then able to be enriched into plutonium that's good for nuclear weapons. Also, the uranium waste can be used in depleted uranium weaponry, which has been used in Iraq and North Africa.
Despite being illegal.
Well, yeah, because it's a weapon of mass and indiscriminate destruction. It leaves behind radiation, basically. So now, yeah, where there's war that we in the West are waging, we're actually leaving behind radioactive zones.
Okay, well, harking back to activism, you told us what has been going on in Germany. What has actually been going on in Britain against nuclear?
Well, our first major action that we are planning will be on October the 3rd this year. We're having a mass blockade of Hinkley Point in Somerset, which is our local power station. It's a publicly announced blockade. It's a mass civil disobedience. We want as many people as possible just to come and show their faces and say we're not into more nuclear power. We think it's dangerous and dirty and expensive.
We want this to be an act of mass civil disobedience, and it's being backed by CND and Trident Ploughshares.
Okay, so this is like a nationally advertised thing that you want, yeah, as many people to turn up.
Yeah. And there's also an action camp over the weekend beforehand. So effectively, we're starting in Bridgewater on Saturday with a demonstration, and then there'll be a campsite where people can meet and learn more about the subject and have workshops and mobilise for the blockade.
I mean, obviously you have a very clear objective about what you want to get out of this, but in light of the recent unorganised civil disobedience involving the riots, do you not expect quite a harsh treatment?
I don't think you can compare it to the riots, but people are pledging publicly in the same way that they do with Trident Ploughshares actions. This is exercising our democratic right, because the government has completely lied to us in their public consultation. They've told us nuclear is green, which it isn't.
So what happens when the riot police turn up?
Well, this is advertised as a non-violent action. Everyone who's taking part is taking part non-violently and peacefully. And if the police decide to come in with riot vans and things, then they will look extremely bad. And they're aware of that. And they have spoken to us and said that that's not what they're intending to do.
Right. But what would you say to people who might say, well, isn't this just an example of NIMBYism or something? I mean, if the power plant was in Northumberland or something, you wouldn't be travelling all the way up there.
No, well, we're part of Stop Nuclear Power Network, which is comprised by loads of organisations who are anti-nuclear, CND and everything. Everyone's coming together to actually stop nuclear power all over the country.
Okay. So actually, it wouldn't matter where the power station was, you'd still be interested.
The reason we're starting at Hinkley is because that's the first power station that's being planned to be built. That's the first one they want to get out. The next one will be at Sizewell, which is the previous site we've been to visit on the other side of the country. Now, and people will be coming from all over the country to take part in the blockade.
Okay. Harking back to Japan, which we did mention briefly earlier on, I mean, what about evacuation? What if something goes wrong? I mean, we're not really on a fault line as such. It's not likely to be a big earthquake or anything, but what if something goes wrong? What about people in Bristol?
Well, that's a question we're taking to Bristol City Council next week on the 6th of September. They're having an open meeting and we're going to them just to ask that question. What is the evacuation plan for Bristol? Because in fact, Bristol is within 30 miles of Hinkley Point. It's also within 30 miles of Oldbury. And if something went wrong at either of those reactors, or in fact, if some of the nuclear waste they transport through the city was to spill or cause an accident, then everyone in Bristol would have to be evacuated. It affects all of us.
Okay, so if people want to ask questions about that, I understand there's an event taking place on the 6th of September?
Yes, I mean, the question we've had to put forward, a few of us from Swan have put them forward.
Yeah.
They can write to their councillors and ask them, what is the evacuation plan? In fact, I wrote to my own MP the whole time that Fukushima was going on, Stephen Williams. I wrote to him loads of emails. He's only answered one letter back. And when I asked him each time about the evacuation plan, and the only answer I've ever got in the one letter was the same as it always has been.
Right.
So is there an evacuation plan?
What specifically is it? So what is taking place briefly on the 6th of September?
It's a full council meeting, and you can pose questions at any full council meeting. any citizen of Bristol can do that.
We'll also be outside the council house with some banners and placards.
Outside
and
the council
house
itself, right. And that will be about 6 o'clock, I understand. So if there's one sort of brief piece of advice, I suppose, as finished, what can people do in the meantime?
If you get your energy from EDF Energy, boycott them. They're the ones behind the nuclear new build in this country. So go to Boycott EDF website. It shows you some very simple steps of how to do so, and let them know you're boycotting them because they're behind nuclear power.
Okay, people want to get in touch with you. How can they get in touch to find out more, you know, if they want to join in?
You can email Southwest Against Nuclear on swanactive, that's SWANACTIVE, @gmail.com. If you want to find out more about the blockade, it's at stopnewnuclear.org.
Yeah, if you want to support Stop Hinkley, there's a petition online to Stop Hinkley. It's already got over 10,000 signatures, and that's the Stop Hinkley website.
Okay, brilliant. Well, with that, thank you very much, and I wish you all the best of luck, and I'm sure we'll have either yourselves or some representatives on the future to tell us how it's been going.
Thank you.
A new museum has opened in Edinburgh. It's all about the history of banking and is housed in a former bank in the centre of the city. Dalek's Anthea Page went along to meet the curator and find out more.
Museum on the Mound. It's a museum that's dedicated to the history of money, and I'm sitting here with the curator, Doug Macbeth, and we're overlooking Scott's Memorial. Wonderful view from the window. Hello. Now, this building that the museum was formerly a bank, I believe.
It was purpose-built as the head office of the Bank of Scotland and was originally completed in 1806. The bank itself had gone back to 1695, but after 100 years he thought, you know, we've had enough with renting accommodation and the problems that brings with it, so we'll have our own purpose-built head office, and he chose this site specifically. But the building that we're in today, parts of it are that original building from 1806, but it was extensively remodelled and made larger in the 1860s and 1870s.
I've noticed that there's not much decoration left inside the building. Is that when they took most of it out?
There wouldn't be much moulding down here. If you go upstairs, there's a lot. The floor we're in now, where the museum is, was the original vaults. So the entrance to the museum was actually an office window until 5 years ago, when the museum opened in this form.
Now, you mentioned the date 1695. I believe that's when the first banknotes were issued.
Not quite. First banknotes were issued in 1696. The Bank of Scotland was founded in 1695. They didn't start issuing banknotes until March 1696.
How did they come across the idea of printing banknotes?
Other people had tried it. The earliest known paper banknotes are actually going back to about the 10th century in China. And rumour has it that Marco Polo first brought the idea back to Europe, and everyone just laughed at him. Several Scandinavian banks tried to do paper money in the mid-17th century, but didn't control it properly, so they issued far too much and then went bankrupt. And the Bank of England, that was founded in 1694, was using paper money before the Bank of Scotland, but they weren't banknotes as we know them today. They were more like cash receipts. So if you deposited £300, 5 shillings and sixpence, you got a hand-completed note for £300, 5 shillings and sixpence that you could then adjust the value off it. In 1696, Bank of Scotland issued at denominations of 5, 10, 20, 50 and £100, the same ones we still do today. So we were the first European bank to successfully introduce paper money in set denominations.
Did other banks quickly follow that example?
Yes. I say Bank of England were using a form of paper money, as were many other banks. But once Bank of Scotland took the next step, which was doing set denominations, everybody quickly followed.
Looking around the museum, there's some fascinating exhibits, and one display actually talks about life assurances. When did that start?
Life assurance, sporadically, has been on the go for centuries. I think the earliest known case, again, comes from Italy in about the 12th or 13th century. Life assurance industry, as we know it today, was a result of the 18th century. Basically, once you had the Fire of London, you started getting fire assurance companies where companies would sell you fire insurance, and if your property burned down, they would send their own fire brigade to try and put out the fire. Once the government decided it would actually have proper municipal fire brigades, that sector pretty much died overnight. So they all started offering life assurance as an alternative. It kind of grew out of the Industrial Revolution as well, in that you suddenly had a middle class for the first time. These people, relatively well-paid professionals, were quite often the sole breadwinner for a family. And also, they had spare money that they wanted to invest. And many of the first life assurance companies were essentially PLCs under another name. You had shareholders. So they wanted to both have a policy to look after their family should they die, but at the same time invest their own money in them as well, because it was such a lucrative business back in the early 19th century.
When did that expand to travel insurance?
Pretty much from day one. If you look at sort of the information we have in the museum, one of the things that our earliest life insurance company connected with Lloyds Banking Group as it is today, which is Clerical Medical, they had an old atlas in the office with red lines drawn in it. Now, if you were travelling north of the northernmost red line or south of the southernmost red line, and that's pretty much all of Europe and North America and South America, South Africa and Australia, you were only charged what was known as a sea risk. You were charged an extra premium to cover you in case something went wrong on your several weeks journey on the boat. But presuming you made it safely to the other side, you're expected to have as good a life as you would if you stayed at home. The problem area was the bit in between, essentially the tropical area, Central America, Caribbean, most of Africa, India, sort of Asia around about Malaysia, Singapore, Borneo, all this kind of place where you had piracy. Piracy was rife. It wasn't civilized, even as you knew the word back then. But the biggest killer was all these wonderful diseases that your average white European had never encountered before. And certainly somewhere like the west coast of Africa became known as the white man's graveyard, because so many people were just catching diseases like yellow fever and dying. I think one in three people died if they went to Africa just because of diseases.
You had travel insurance. Did that ensure your body to be brought back and buried here if that happened?
Not necessarily. Travel insurance as such still didn't exist. It was just an extension on your life assurance. So you still took out life assurance. But if you said that you were going to Africa, you would have to pay a higher amount for your life assurance. You still got the same out of it. Your family, if so, you took out life assurance for £100, you had to pay a lot more for that cover than you would have if you'd stayed in Britain. But your family would have just got the £100 should anything happen to you. Your body would just have just been buried there and then, kind of thing. It was no sort of repatriation back there.
That's all we have time for this week from Anthea, but you can hear part two in next week's show when our reporter strikes a coin at the museum. Our next feature is by Mike Noyce, usually our engineer who's branched out. He's continuing his chats with local bands, and up this week is Dharma Foundation.
Oh, I'm here today with Ewan Exon and Rory Floyd from Dharma Foundation.
Hello. Hello.
Right, so how did you two get together?
Well, we met whilst we were studying. Mm-hmm. So we've been studying for the last couple of years, doing the same course.
Both come from quite very different band backgrounds, and then met whilst we're doing this course, and yeah, I guess enough of our tastes were similar that we decided to join forces.
So how would you describe your music?
The easiest way to put it is ambient. I mean, we do have elements of reggae and hip-hop and things in there, but yeah, predominantly it's ambient sounds.
Yeah. However you want to define that.
Yeah. Obviously, as it's just the two of you, presumably there's quite a big difference between the way you play live and what you can do in the studio.
Sure. Well, the live thing's been our main sort of thing. I mean, I use a loop station, so the majority of the rhythm and the chord sequences and things like that, I build up as layers on the loop station. And then over the top, we both use quite a lot of guitar effects.
Yeah. Well, I guess Ewan lays down the basic foundations of the track, using his guitar and loop station. And then I'll use effects of my own as well. So I'll lay down drones or sort of bowed notes, something like that, and then put a bass line on top, which just gives it more depth, more texture.
Yeah, a lot more bulk. But of course, with the recording, we had a lot more time to play around with putting more stuff behind it. So with the tracks that we've got, we've put bits of djembe on it, bits of beatboxing. And also the guy who produced it, he put on some synth sounds, things like that for us. So it gives it a much bigger feel, I think.
Yeah. But that said, we're always trying to improve what we can do live. So we've started off with basic amount of effects and technology, and we're always looking to kind of progress and see what exactly we can get away with doing live, just the two of us, or maybe with another member.
That said, now let's hear a snippet of your track, Fire in My Belly.
Suffering as my heart pounds, 'cause my baby walked away every time that my focus strayed. Well, she's seen straight through me, oh, that's what I believed. But it turns out that she's just as confused and lost as me. But I'll push myself until my dying day, 'cause I've too much to say, even though my voice is choked away. The fire in my belly will set my soul free. I'm going back to my family where I can be free, 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 free.
That was a bit of Fire in My Belly, and hopefully we'll get to hear the whole of that at the end of the show. How are you getting your music out there?
Well, at the moment, we've got a 3-track CD that we're going to be bringing out. Well, by the time this is aired, it'll be out, releasing on the 8th of August, 2011. And that's going to be available for people to download for free off the SoundCloud account. You can find us on there. You can also get us on MySpace, things like that. We're also going to be going out to as many open mic nights as we can, just as a starting point. So if you see us out and about at any of the various wonderful open mic nights that are in Bristol, you can probably grab a copy of the CD from us.
SoundCloud, was it?
Yeah, that's SoundCloud. So if you just look up the name Dharma Foundation in SoundCloud or MySpace, so that's Dharma's D-H-A-R-M-A Foundation. Yeah, you should be able to find us pretty easy on there.
So how is your music likely to progress, do you think?
Well, I think, as I said before, we're always trying to expand what we can do live. You've got so much creative freedom in the studio, it's pretty much limitless, but it's very constraining trying to replicate that live, especially just with two people. So I think we're going to possibly get a third member, probably trying to do things like live vocal manipulation and being able to sync drum beats live to the tempos that Ewan's setting. I think that'd be really interesting, and just generally adding more dynamics, more effects, more sounds and textures, and just really bringing that kind of sound that we've got to life live.
Yeah. And we're also, it's been a sort of back thought for a little while, but I think it's probably going to start happening more and more in the coming days, that we want to have maybe two separate projects. So we'll carry on with the ambient, chilled out live sounds, but we'll also try and have a dancier project so that we can also go into nightclubs and places like that. But they'll run as separate projects, but also under the same umbrella of Dharma Foundation or Dharma Collective, and we'll try and pull as many musicians as possible to work towards that end.
Okay, well, Dharma Foundation, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So if you want to listen to Dharma Foundation, you can either go to www.soundcloud.com or www.myspace.com and search for Dharma Foundation. That's D-H-A-R-M-A Foundation. Or if you want to contact them, you can go to dharmafoundationuk@gmail.com.
Thanks very much to the guys from Dharma Foundation. They were speaking to Mike Noyce. Listen out for those guys at the end of our show, and we'll put one of their tracks as the play-out track. Bristol's historic Filton Airfield is set to close to make way for housing, handed over to developers as a symbol, many would say, of Britain's industrial decline. So Dialect's been looking back at Bristol's role in aviation history. Now more from our very own aircraft museum, the Bristol Aero Collection, based an hour or so's drive away at the Kemble Airfield in Gloucestershire. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to the collection's chairman, Oliver Dearden, about the unique set of circumstances that led to the 1969 rolling out in Filton of what is still the most advanced passenger aircraft in the world, capable of 1,350 miles an hour, twice the speed of sound. But Oliver starts by expressing his frustration having the Bristol Aero Collection so far away from the city.
We've been trying to go back to Filton for years. We've been very active at trying to... We've been very much involved with Airbus because we ran the tours around Concorde, which unfortunately have finished. The whole idea is to get this exhibition back in Bristol, which is where it belongs. But, we need all this space. And it's not there isn't any space at Filton, believe it or not. What? The last aircraft ever produced at Filton was the last Concorde in 1979. They haven't built an aeroplane there since. All they make is bits of aeroplanes now. They send a lot of wing components up to Broughton, near Chester, where the Airbus wings are made, and they're taken to the continent to be finished off in the complete aeroplane. So Bristol has not built a complete aeroplane now for 40 years. It's an excellent design office now, and it produces components for the wings.
Why is it that there's been such a decline in our aviation that we're able to produce in this country?
Every Airbus that flies, the wings have been made in this country. It's a European-wide business now. Airbus assemble aircraft in Toulouse. The fuselages can be made in Germany. The wings are made here. In fact, bits of aeroplane are now made all over the world. Bits of Boeing aircraft are made in Bristol these days.
We've got to have a look at Concorde, haven't we?
Yes. Yeah, we'll go to Concorde now. Until Concorde at Filton finds its new home and is open to the public again, this is the only Concorde in this area, there's one at Yeovilton, but this is the only one you can visit. And you'll see teddy bears around. That's for children. When children come to the museum, there's a competition to see how many teddy bears they can find. And if they find the right number, they get a prize. This is a model of the test rig where Concorde was tested at Farnborough. Not only was it loaded and unloaded as test rigs normally do, it was heated and cooled. There's a Concorde tyre. There's the roof of the Concorde cockpit. And here's the mock-up. Now, when you were building a new airliner, you would build a wooden mock-up, because that was to show the airlines what it was like before it had been built. And it was also used as a trial, seeing how you could deal with passengers. And so here is the Concorde mock-up. Research into supersonic commercial travel was going on in the mid-50s. And by 1958, a considerable amount of work was going on at Filton onto a supersonic airliner. I worked on it. It was the Bristol 198, which was very similar to Concorde, performed similarly. But as 1958, yes, work was going on. In parallel with that, the Sud Aviation Company in France were going along a parallel path, and they were coming to very similar conclusions as to what the aeroplane would look like and what it could do. As after a lot of to and froing between the two countries, they decided to collaborate on the design. And so in 1962, you got the Anglo-French Concorde Agreement signed, which they agreed to cooperate and build a commercial supersonic aircraft. They were slightly ahead of the Russians and the Americans. They persevered with it. There was an awful lot of new technology in it, as you can imagine. The Americans tried and failed. They spent nearly as much as we did, but only ever produced a model, because they went for Mach 3, which was too big a step. The Russians built theirs, which was not successful commercially. It did go supersonic, but it could not perform like this one. They got this one right.
So why is it, do you think, that we in Bristol were able to steal a march on the Russians and the Americans in the middle of the Cold War?
Yes, it's amazing, really. Over the years, they were just developing the technology to do it, and it was very complex.
Was it a sort of adaptation of some of the military technology?
Well, it was adaptation of all sorts of things. Supersonic experience. Even they got some experience from guided weapons, because they were flying at similar speeds. And so they had a whole wealth background on which to base it. One of the most amazing developments was the intakes on Concorde are very complicated, the engine intakes. When the aircraft is flying at Mach 2, 1,350 miles an hour, the air is entering the engine at 1,350 miles an hour. The face of the engine is a bit further back. The engine only wants air that's doing 500 miles an hour, because it would flame out if it was going any faster. It can only cope with it at that speed. So you had to slow it down. The Concorde engine intake is a very complicated structure. It's got ramps and things to slow the air down, reduce the energy in this. And that was controlled by a digital computer in 1969. Nobody had ever heard of them. They had to write the language at Filton for it. They built a complete fuselage and one wing of wood in a flight hangar at Filton. And this is the forward passenger cabin. The cockpit is down in the Industrial Museum. But this is the forward passenger cabin. It's full size. It's got seating. Well, go and have a look. There is a front cabin in Concorde, which has 40 seats. Where we stood, we're looking into it from the middle of the aircraft. The cockpit will be right at the front. Behind us is the rear cabin with 60 seats in it. So, welcome aboard Concorde. Bearing in mind, these furnishings are 45 years old, or more now. This is the size of Concorde. Those are seats that have actually flown. They're out of a production Concorde. The luggage bins are correct. The size is correct. The lighting is correct. The windows are right. The seats aren't quite what they would be, but try one for size.
Now, the one thing I notice about this is the windows are tiny, 6 inches high and 3 or 4 inches across. The tiny windows. Why is that?
What's the view at 55,000 feet? The sky. Dark blue. The curvature of the earth. The sky is a slightly darker colour. Windows have to be strong enough. Don't forget the inside air pressure here in Concorde was equivalent to about 6,000 feet. 55,000 feet, the air outside is almost non-existent, so you've got this big differential pressure.
So why did Concorde fly higher than most ordinary airliners then?
Because there's less resistance to it. It can go faster up there. It gets up to 11 miles high. One of the safety factors, if the windows break, which they can do, the aircraft will suffer a decompression.
Ouch, and that will hurt your ears, probably.
Well, not only that, it hurts the passengers, because when that happens, when you fly, you're told where the oxygen masks are. Within a matter of seconds, all that's got to happen. Now, in Concorde state, it's just the area of the windows got to be kept small. In fact, the earliest design had no windows at all, but the decided passengers wouldn't like that. You can see quite a lot out of them. You try a seat next to the window.
Yeah, I can see into your storage end of the hangar here. Yeah,
that's right, yeah. So I don't think you'd go on holiday very well in Concorde, do you? You won't get much in the luggage rack, would
not
you?
Not a lot. Maybe two or three handbags, that sort of size.
Yes, but otherwise it's conventional. You've got a seat tray, like everybody else. The production aircraft had four displays here that showed you how fast you were going, what height you were at, the outside temperature.
Rather like the modern planes now. When you fly now, you get a little screen in front of you, don't you? Telling you things like where you are, this kind of thing.
This is the forward galley, which was a bit bigger in the end. The toilets are a bit small. It's all here. See, this is only a mock-up. This is the doorway you'd come in. There's the flight attendant's telephone. Here's all the controls, just as they are on the real aeroplane. Here you've got the ovens for the food. There you would have the cockpit.
Now, what about the successor otherwise of the Concorde? Because there was actually quite a lot of pressure on the government to pull the plug on it, but it was actually at the cutting edge of technology.
It was indeed, and it got to a stage when it would be more expensive to cancel it than it would carry on. Sounds rather like aircraft carriers today, doesn't it?
We've had things like the Nimrods cancelled recently, where you wonder, actually, hundreds of millions of pounds spent on something, and then nothing to show at the end of the day.
So all this is because it wasn't even British Airways, it's BOAC. I think it was up to the French, wouldn't let them get out of it in the end. But it is amazing it was made. Yes, it cost an awful lot of money. Technically, it was a brilliant success because it all worked. Sadly, apart from the one accident at Paris, which is always a bit of a mystery, it had an excellent record. Yeah.
That was Dialect's Tony Gosling talking to chairman of the Bristol Aero Collection, Oliver Dearden. The collection is based at the Kemble Airfield in Gloucestershire and open into the autumn on Sundays and Mondays. Much like the Kingswood Heritage Museum in Warmley, and indeed us, the Bristol Aero Collection is staffed by volunteers, and it faces funding shortfalls as part of the LibCon cuts. So if you want to visit it, do so soon. Next week, Concorde's demise. Next up, we have Part 4, Chapter 18 of Treasure Island, where a well-known figure makes a reappearance. As ever, this next instalment of Robert Louis Stevenson's adventure, his swashbuckling tale, is read by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 4, The Stockade. Chapter 18, narrative continued by the Doctor. End of the first day's fighting. We made our best speed across the strip of wood that now divided us from the stockade. And at every step we took, the voices of the buccaneers rang nearer. Soon we could hear their footfalls as they ran and the cracking of the branches as they breasted across a bit of thicket. I began to see we should have a brush for it in earnest and looked to my priming. "Captain," said I, "Trelawney is the dead shot. Give him your gun, his own is useless." They exchanged guns, and Trelawney, silent and cool as he had been since the beginning of the bustle, hung a moment on his heel to see that all was fit for service. At the same time observing Grey to be unarmed, I handed him my cutlass. It did all our hearts good to see him spit in his hand, knit his brows, and make the blade sing through the air. It was plain from every line of his body that our new hand was worth his salt. 40 paces farther, we came to the edge of the wood and saw the stockade in front of us. We struck the enclosure about the middle of the south side, and almost at the same time, 7 mutineers, Job Anderson, the boatswain, at their head, appeared in full cry at the southwestern corner. They paused as if taken aback, and before they recovered, not only the squire and I, but Hunter and Joyce from the blockhouse had time to fire. The 4 shots came in rather a scattering volley, but they did the business. One of the enemy actually fell, and the rest, without hesitation, turned and plunged into the trees. After loading, we walked down the outside of the palisade to see to the fallen enemy. He was stone dead, shot through the heart. We began to rejoice over our good success, when just at that moment a pistol cracked in the bush, a ball whistled close past my ear, and poor Tom Redruth stumbled and fell his length on the ground. Both the squire and I returned the shot, but as we had nothing to aim at, it is probable we only wasted powder. Then we reloaded and turned our attention to poor Tom. The captain and Grey were already examining him, and I saw with half an eye that all was over. I believe the readiness of our return volley had scattered the mutineers once more, for we were suffered without further molestation to get the poor old gamekeeper hoisted over the stockade and carried groaning and bleeding into the log-house. Poor old fellow. He had uttered not one word of surprise, complaint, fear, or even acquiescence from the very beginning of our troubles till now, when we had laid him down in the log-house to die. He had lain like a Trojan behind his mattress in the gallery. He had followed every order silently, doggedly, and well. He was the oldest of our party by a score of years. And now, sullen, old, serviceable servant, it was he that was to die. The squire dropped down beside him on his knees and kissed his hand, crying like a child. "Be I going, doctor?" he asked. "Tom, my man," said I, "you're going home." "I wish I'd had a lick at them with my gun first," he replied. "Tom," said the squire, "say you forgive me, won't you? Would that be respectful-like from me to you, squire?" was the answer. "Howsoever, so be it. Amen." After a little while of silence, he said he thought somebody might read a prayer. "It's the custom, sir," he added apologetically. And not long after, without another word, he passed away. In the meantime, the captain, whom I had observed to be wonderfully swollen about the chest and pockets, had turned out a great many various stores. The British colours, a Bible, a coil of stoutish rope, pen, ink, the logbook, and pounds of tobacco. He had found a longish fir tree lying felled and cleared in the enclosure, and with the help of Hunter, he had set it up at the corner of the log-house, where the trunks crossed and made an angle. Then, climbing on the roof, he had with his own hand bent and run up the colours. This seemed mightily to relieve him. He re-entered the log-house and set about counting up the stores as if nothing else existed. But he had an eye on Tom's passage for all that, and as soon as all was over, came forward with another flag and reverently spread it on the body. "Don't you take on, sir," he said, shaking the squire's hand. "All's well with him. No fear for a hand that's been shot down in his duty to captain and owner. It mayn't be good divinity, but it's a fact." Then he pulled me aside. "Dr. Livesey," he said, "in how many weeks do you and squire expect the consort?" I told him it was a question not of weeks, but of months. That if we were not back by the end of August, Blandley was to send to find us, but neither sooner nor later. "You can calculate for yourself," I said. "Why, yes," returned the captain, scratching his head. "And making a large allowance, sir, for all the gifts of Providence, I should say we were pretty close hauled." "How do you mean?" I asked. "It's a pity, sir, we lost that second load. That's what I mean," replied the captain. "As for powder and shot, we'll do. But the rations are short. Very short. So short, Dr. Livesey, that we're, perhaps, as well without that extra mouth." And he pointed to the dead body under the flag. Just then, with a roar and a whistle, a round shot passed high above the roof of the log-house and plumped far beyond us in the wood. "Oho," said the captain, "blaze away. You've little enough powder already, my lads." At the second trial, the aim was better, and the ball descended inside the stockade, scattering a cloud of sand, but doing no further damage. "Captain," said the squire, "the house is quite invisible from the ship. It must be the flag they're aiming at. Would it not be wiser to take it in?" "Strike my colours?" cried the captain. "No, sir, not I." And as soon as he had said the words, I think we all agreed with him, for it was not only a piece of stout, seemingly good feeling. It was good policy besides, and showed our enemies that we despised their cannonade. All through the evening they kept thundering away. Ball after ball flew over or fell short, or kicked up the sand in the enclosure. But they had to fire so high that the shot fell dead and buried itself in the soft sand. We had no ricochet to fear. And though one popped in through the roof of the log-house and out again through the floor, we soon got used to that sort of horseplay, and minded it no more than cricket. "There is one good thing about all this," observed the captain. "The wood in front of us is likely clear. The ebb has made a good while. Our stores should be uncovered. Volunteers to go and bring in pork. Gray and Hunter were the first to come forward. Well armed, they stole out of the stockade. But it proved a useless mission. The mutineers were bolder than we fancied, or they put more trust in Israel's gunnery. For four or five of them were busy carrying off our stores and wading out with them to one of the gigs that lay close by, pulling an oar or so to hold us steady against the current. Silver was in the stern sheets, in command, and every man of them was now provided with a musket from some secret magazine of their own. The captain sat down to his log, and here is the beginning of the entry. Alexander Smollett, master. David Livesey, ship's doctor. Abraham Gray, carpenter's mate. John Trelawney, owner. John Hunter and Richard Joyce, owner's servants, landsmen, being all that is left faithful of the ship's company, with stores for 10 days at short rations, came ashore this day and flew British colours on the log-house on Treasure Island. Thomas Redruth, owner's servant, landsman, shot by the mutineers. James Hawkins, cabin boy. And at the same time, I was wondering over poor Jim Hawkins' fate. A hail on the land side. "Somebody's hailing us," said Hunter, who was on guard. "Doctor! Squire! Captain! Hello, Hunter! Is that you?" came the cries. And I ran to the door in time to see Jim Hawkins, safe and sound, come climbing over the stockade.
Many thanks to Malcolm Grieve for reading the latest episode of Treasure Island, and more of that coming up next week. Time for some poetry, and this week we have Mark Sayers. Hello.
Hello.
And what do you have for us today?
I have a poem which I wrote whilst waiting outside Cafe Number 1 in Clifton Village for a lady who later said that she had got the time wrong. It's called "It's Their Prerogative, I Know." I stand outside the smart cafe, folk thinking, why is this puzzled greybeard waiting? He looks such a fool. Now young men stroll by with cute, cool dreamboats as young housewives appear with kids meeting for coffee here. There's one thing puzzles me, I find, and that's when ladies change their mind. It's their prerogative, I know, to meet or not, to come or go. And yet, I really can't blame her. For would I make that dame's heart stir? Would I make her swoon and say, wow, to think that I'm the lucky cow out of the dozens Mark could date? There is no doubt this must be fate that's calling me out of the blue. Is this a dream? It can't be true. None say, you're so like Gregory Peck. I see my bald pate say, oh heck, half blind, half deaf, with hearing aids, my evenings chatting up barmaids. Surgeons who stood in for my op claimed that I'd not come out on top. I'll never cause a mighty stir and hear the ladies start to purr. I'll never make Polish girls faint or flaunt long earrings looking quaint, wearing false eyelashes and rouge, begging me to give them refuge. It's their prerogative, I know, to change their minds. That's how things go. Life has its ups and downs, that's true. We've not said hello, toodaloo, or even hi there, or goodbye. And so, I can't help wondering why.
half blind and half deaf, but we like his poetry. And that was very funny. We liked it. So the Mark Sears, thank you very much. And please come again. Hello to Tim Burrows.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm very well. This is a love poem. The light touch, the fleeting caress, the sideways glimpse as you undress. Always the subtle subtext, the hints of closeness that reflect those timeless moments of close focus. Those intimate shots in the dust of darkness, those reflections in a glass, as the lamplight shimmers through the arch of passion, as the moon quarters the time-touched passing moments of the heartfelt night.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, he was born to raise hell, and we don't mind, so long as he doesn't creak in front of the microphone in his leather jacket. So, Jess Barks, what is on this week?
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 9th of September, Urban Funk Star, Zion Flex, Alone Star, Katraz, DJ Reverb, plus special guests will all be performing at the Green Bank in Bellevue Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Also on 9th of September, First Degree Burns will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I present Medieval Babes. This group formed in 1997 and to date have released 6 studio albums and 1 live album. This is from the debut album Salva Nos, which was released in 1997, and it's the track Salva Nos. Medieval Babes with Salva Nos from the album Salva Nos. They'll be embarking on a UK Christmas tour which starts in Bournemouth on 13th of December. For more information, check out www.medievalbabes, that is spelt medievalbabes.com. On Saturday, 10th of September, it's Doors Open Day in Bristol. This is when significant contemporary and historic buildings open their doors to the general public. Entry is free to all buildings and the event starts at 10 a.m. For more information, you can check out www.bristoldoorsopenday.org. Finally, on Sunday, 11th of September, Toots and the Maytals will be performing with support from Talisman at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets cost £24 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Well, if you've enjoyed the poetry, you may be interested in knowing that there are some poetry events coming up. In mid to late September, we have the Bristol Poetry Festival. So here are the two events which are hosted and organised and involving people that you've heard on the radio on our show. 20 poets perform at the Bristol Central Library Cafe. Bristol Central Library, if you don't know where that is College Green, right next to the cathedral. That's hosted by Mark Sayers. And that's on Saturday the 17th of September. It starts at midday and goes on until 3. Also, Tim Burrows is involved in the Lansdowne Poetry event at the Lansdowne Pub in Clifton, Clifton Road specifically, and that's on Monday the 19th of September at 8 p.m. Admission to that is £3, so limited entry, seeing as the place is of a limited size. Best to get in touch, I'll read out the website in a second. And that involves poetry and poetry films from the Lansdowne Poets and is hosted by Charles Thompson. If you're interested in finding out more, you can always have a look on the website, www.poetrycan.co.uk, or you can contact the Poetry Can on 0117 933 0900, or you can even email them info@poetrycan.co.uk. Well, that was Dialects. On this week's show, I spoke to Ornella and Zoe from Southwest Against Nuclear. Features were by Anthea Page, Tony Gosling and Mike Noyce. We also had poetry from Tim Burrows and Mark Sayers. Malcolm Grieve read us another part of Treasure Island, and Jeff Sparks gave us the What's On. The engineer was Mike Noyce and the producer was Michaela Dennis. That's all for this week. I'm John Peters Coleman. Have a good week and we'll see you next Sunday. Goodbye.
Myself until my dying day, 'cause I've too much to say, and all my voice is choked away. The fire in my belly will set my soul free. I'm going back to my family where I can be free, 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 free. Committed crimes that seem unforgivable, but nothing's irretrievable. And do good people ever get what they want in life, like spiritual accomplishment and the strength to fight? Well, somebody must do, somebody has. So somebody tell me please now, what's the plan when the fire in my belly has set my soul free? I'm going back to my family where I can be free. The fire in my belly will set my soul free.